Good evening. Donald Trump agrees to pay $2 million in damages for violating New York State charitable organization laws. New York City votes, and Planned Parenthood gets a win from a New York federal judge. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, November 7th, 2019. New York Attorney General Letitia James announced Tuesday the New York Supreme Court has ordered Donald J. Trump to pay $2 million in damages for improperly using charitable assets to intervene in the 2016 presidential primaries. The award is part of Attorney General James's lawsuit against the Donald J. Trump Foundation and its directors Trump, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, and Eric Trump. The Attorney General commented, "The Trump Foundation has shut down. Funds that were illegally misused are being restored. The president will be subject to ongoing supervision by my office, and the Trump children had to undergo compulsory training to ensure this type of illegal activity never takes place again." In her decision ordering Trump to pay $2 million, Justice Sally Ann Scarpula said Mr. Trump breached his fiduciary responsibility to the foundation. It includes an admission by Trump that the foundation's board of directors, of which he was chair, failed to meet, failed to provide oversight over the foundation, and failed to adopt legally required policies and procedures. As a separate piece of the settlement, Donald Trump Jr. reimbursed the foundation for the $10,000 cost of a portrait of Donald Trump. The settlement also requires the foundation to be reimbursed $11,525 for sports paraphernalia and champagne purchased at a charity gala. The $1.78 million in assets currently being held by the Trump Foundation, along with the $2 million in damages paid by Trump, will be dispersed equally to eight charities: Army Emergency Relief, the Children's Aid Society, City Meals on Wheels, Given Hour, Martha's Table, United Negro College Fund, United Way of National Capital Area, and the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. The charities, which were required as part of the resolution to the be entities that did not have any relationship with Mr. Trump or entities he controlled, were approved by the Office of the Attorney General and the court. And it was an off-year election this week, but its impact on local and national politics was significant. In New York City, voters made changes Tuesday to the way they vote, implementing ranked choice voting in primary elections that allows voters to rank their selections for office, giving less well-known candidates a better chance of being elected. Voters also added more members to the board that oversees police misconduct, extended a ban on lobbying for former elected officials, and created a rainy day fund in the city's budget. A measure was approved that modifies the Uniform Land Use Review Process, or ULURP, giving community boards more time to consider land use proposals. The measure also requires the Department of City Planning to provide more information on major projects. Andrew Berman is Executive Director of Village Preservation, a supporter of the measure that passed on Tuesday.
It gives New York City residents a little bit more of an ability to have a say in how their city and their neighborhoods are developed. It is a modest change, but it is at least a step in the right direction. First of all, it ensures that over the summer, when a lot of community boards and a lot of people are unable to participate in the public review process, that there's a little bit of extra time, really just 2 weeks to 30 days, to ensure that those land use applications that have such a huge impact on our lives and our city get a full public vetting, and that the public has the opportunity to weigh in on it. It also would require that 30 days before these applications are certified with the city, that the city produce a detailed project summary that goes to the borough president, the borough board, and the community board about exactly what it is that's coming down the pike. So it gives people a little additional time to understand what's happening and to formulate how they may or may not want to react to it or engage the process. We still have a long way to go to make a truly responsive land use public review process in New York City, but at least this was a small step in the right direction.
What does ULURP do? What does it mean, and what does it actually do? What does it entail?
It's the Uniform Land Use Review Procedure, and it came out of the efforts of community activists in the 1960s, led by people like Jane Jacobs, against the Robert Moses School of Thought about development, which is that a couple of powerful people should have all of the decision-making capacity, and affected neighborhoods, residents, communities, really really should have no say on it. This was the response to that, which set up a formal process where land use applications had to go through several different kinds of public hearing and review processes where the public was at least notified and given a chance to weigh in on it and supposedly have their feedback taken into account, as well as having the impact of the proposed changes analyzed. Now, I think it would be generous at best to say that it's come anywhere close to living up to what it was supposed to be, but it certainly at least provides more of an opportunity for communities and the public to both be notified of and to in some way engage and be involved with the decision-making process. This just makes it a little more accessible and adds a little more knowledge and transparency to the process and to the public's ability to partake.
Department of City Planning is sort of part of this process as well, and I've done interviews where it's been said that they're just a rubber stamp. Is that true, and are they affected at all by their powers affected by this proposition?
The public can have an effect. I think without a doubt the City Planning Commission, the majority of whose members are appointed by the mayor, basically do the bidding of the mayor. But neither this mayor nor any other mayor is impervious to public pressure through a variety of means. And the public hearing process is one way in which you can get the word out there that communities are upset by or happy about or are seeking changes to a proposed land use action. Actually pretty rare that when an application doesn't goes through the process that there aren't at least some changes to it in response to the oftentimes they're nowhere near as substantial as opponents or other affected parties want it to be. But I think we're really just shooting ourselves in the foot if we say, oh, it's, you know, it's entirely a dog and pony show and we have no ability to affect the outcome. The only way we're sure of losing is if we don't take up the fight.
And when does this take effect?
I believe it takes effect immediately. Moving forward, the proposition should be affecting the way in which these applications are processed. Now, the extended comment period of time affects summer, so it's not really going to kick in until next year, but the 30-day in advance detailed project summary, once a project has been certified, I believe the city's going to start doing that right away for new projects coming down the pike. So hopefully we'll see some manifestations of this pretty soon.
Like the plan to for the East River Park flood control project.
If it has not yet been certified, presumably this would apply to it. I would double-check about the question of exactly when it takes effect, but looking at the plain language, it doesn't say anything about there being a date by which it's effective, so I would assume that it takes effect immediately.
Andrew Berman is Executive Director of Village Preservation. In other election news, public advocate Jumaane Williams held on to his seat, winning 78% of the vote. And in Queens, former borough president Melinda Katz was elected district attorney. In more election news, GOP strategists differed on lessons learned from election results Tuesday, where Democrats made inroads into traditionally conservative districts in Kentucky and Virginia. Democrats also made a strong showing in deep red Mississippi. Some say the results show warning signs for Republicans among crucial suburban voters, while others downplayed the results. In Kentucky, a state Trump won in 2016 by about 30 percentage points, Attorney General Andy Beshear apparently unseated Republican Governor Matt Bevin. In Virginia, which has been trending Democratic for at least a decade, the party flipped both the House of Delegates and the state Senate. But in Mississippi, a socially conservative Democrat was trailing Lieutenant Governor Tate Reeves by 8 percentage points. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions will announce that he is entering the race for his old U.S. Senate seat in Alabama. Sessions, 72, will be making a return to the political stage a year after stepping down as President Donald Trump's first Attorney General when their relationship soured over his recusal from the Russia investigation. And in world news, the South American nation of Chile has been the site of sustained mass protests beginning weeks ago with a hike in transit fare prices. The hike illustrated the widening gap between rich and poor in Chile, which has a tortured history of civil conflict. Protesters and police clashed repeatedly this week in Santiago, Chile's capital city. Despite an apology from President Sebastián Piñera, crowds swelled in a week of protests amid calls by trade unions for a general strike. Police responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannons fired at protesters during sustained pitch battles. Piñera promised social and economic reforms to tackle issues at the heart of the unrest. That include pension raises, affordable medical insurance, lowering the price of medicines, and electricity prices. But Piñera's comments did nothing to calm the protests, which began over a price hike in subway tickets in Santiago. Joining us from Santiago is artist and writer Paula Baru. Why was the focus the subway stations? What has happened as far as subway fares in Chile?
Right now, the president decided to stop the raise of the fare, but that doesn't solve the problem. This happened a few days ago, but people are still in the street because there's so many other issues to solve.
They wanted to raise the fare, the subway fare, is that it?
Yep,
How much did they raise it?
30 pesos. If you think about it, maybe you might, think it's not that much, but in a monthly basis, for a family that doesn't make a lot of money because the minimum salary here is like a joke, you cannot afford that. It's very pricey. It's a lot of money. But that was the tip of the iceberg here. What happened is the people, because of this, because of the students who they took over the stations, people begin to wake up suddenly and begin to have more awareness of their situation, what they had to go through all these years, paying over prices about almost everything that involves almost everything, like the highest education system. We have like very expensive universities here. In order to go to college here, you have to put yourself in debt. It's outrageous. And people begin to react because of that. And it's not only the education, it's the health system, which is really bad, and people still dying in waiting rooms. Pension systems, the minimum salary, now he raised the minimum salary, 50,000 pesos. It's like, a little amount of money. And it's not much. It's not enough.
Chile has a tragic history. In 1972, Salvador Allende, who was the president of your country, was murdered in his presidential palace during a coup led by Augusto Pinochet, who went on to be a dictator and rule with an iron fist for many, many years afterwards, and was never brought to justice for any of the things that happened. Knowing that history, is there fear of a crackdown much more widespread than what we have right now?
There's fear, especially in older people from my generation and older, even older. But this youth, these young people right now, they're not afraid. And most of them are now in the streets because they're not afraid, because they haven't seen anything. They know what happened because of their parents, but they're not directly involved into all that. So most people now, young people, are not afraid of anything. But yes, of course, in older people, my generation and maybe older, there's some fear, of course, that things can get worse. And even the media has been misinformed everything. Media has turned this into a more chaotic episode than it really is, really. But because of they use some of the things that happened before to put some fear in the population. I don't know if you understand what I mean, but they're using what happened before to make the people be afraid of everything that is going on right now.
What are they
saying?
But
the thing is, there's lines, because during Allende's government, people had to do a lot of lines to get food because there wasn't any food. They were doing some pressure in the government to fall, actually. And the media has been put some accents in things that has to do with the past and not really informing what really is going on about people being arrested in their homes or being brutally treated in police stations. around. And that's terrible, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anything like that?
To be united as much as we can. There's a lot of confusion about a lot of information. There's a division between people because of what they think, their political tendencies. And that's hard to be divided like that. We need to be united. We need to be together besides everything, because we cannot allow death. We cannot allow brutality anymore. We lived it many years ago. So we cannot do this again. We cannot go through this again.
All right. Thank you very much, Paula, for joining us on The Torch. And that was Paula Baru, who is a resident, an artist, and a resident of Santiago, Chile. She lives in the area where much of the protesting and violent confrontations with police have occurred in Chile over the last couple of weeks. And you're listening to the news on Locally Controlled, listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. As Mexican soldiers stood guard, a mother and two sons were laid to rest in hand-hewn pine coffins in a single grave dug out of the rocky soil Thursday at the first funeral for the victims of a drug cartel ambush that left 9 American women and children dead. Clad in shirt sleeves, suits, or modest dresses, about 500 mourners embraced in grief under white tents erected in La Mora, a hamlet of about 300 people who consider themselves Mormons but are not affiliated with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Some wept and some sang hymns. Members of the extended community, many of whom, like the victims, are dual U.S.-Mexican citizens, had built the coffins themselves and used shovels to dig the shared grave in Lamora's small cemetery. Farmers and teenage boys carried the coffins. Mourners filed past to view the bodies and pay their final respects to Donna Ray Langford, 43, and her sons Trevor, 11, and Rogan, 2. They were laid to rest together just as they died together Monday when attackers fired a hail of bullets at their SUV on a dirt road leading to another settlement, Colonia LeBaron. 6 children and 3 women in all were killed in the attack on the convoy and 3 SUVs. And in national news, the Trump administration lied about what it called a significant increase in complaints by care providers who had allegedly refused medical care, such as abortion services, to patients. Manhattan federal judge Paul Engelmeyer vacated the entire so-called religious refusal rule, writing in a 147-page decision that the rule had glaring legal defects. The feds had claimed they had received 343 complaints regarding so-called conscience provisions, but the judge said the number was actually 20. The rule was to go into effect on November 22nd. Carmina Bernardo is Planned Parenthood of New York's Senior Director for Public Policy and Regulatory Affairs.
So it's a Trump-Pence administration rule that would have essentially allowed healthcare workers' personal beliefs to dictate patient care. The rule was finalized in May, and it was set to take effect on November 22nd. This refusal of care rule would have endangered patients by granting a range of healthcare workers, from physicians and nurses to receptionists, EMTs and call center staff members, the right to put their personal beliefs ahead of people's health, even in emergencies. And patients could have been denied access to information and healthcare for any reason, simply because the healthcare worker disagrees with a particular service.
How would this have gone beyond just the person's individual desire to do or not do something?
Planned Parenthood of New York City, we provide healthcare services regardless of ability to pay, gender status, income, and we don't turn anybody away. And this rule on the national level would have impacted more than 600,000 health centers, including Planned Parenthood, because it really would have created barriers to providers who want to provide the full range of reproductive health centers. And it would have run counter to our mission of seeing everyone regardless, and it would have required health centers to retain staff workers or even volunteers who do not want to provide the care and information that patients need.
Does this happen a lot? Do you get a lot of complaints of this happening out there?
We have not seen that problem here at Planned Parenthood in New York City, and this is why staff are, ready to provide the full range of sexual and reproductive health services. And this is why striking down this rule is a real victory.
Yeah, so they made this up. They made a problem up that didn't exist. Why would the government do this?
It's part of an ongoing attack the Trump administration has been doing to undermine basic rights As you know, the administration has also tried to block patients from Planned Parenthood health centers, proposed a rule to remove protections for transgender people and people who've had abortions, proposed another rule that would also discourage discrimination in federally funded programs. So it really is part of an ongoing pattern in the Trump-Pence administration of undermining our basic rights.
Has this had an effect? Has it scared people away from getting health services they have a right to get?
We have not seen that. I think that's, again, why it's so important that we achieve this victory.
Have you read any of Judge Engelmeyer's decision? Do you have any opinions on what he had to say? I haven't had a chance either to read the 147-page decision, but that seems long. It seems longer than usual.
We haven't had a chance yet to actually read the decision, correct.
That's interesting. This is part of a continuing attack on service providers such as Planned Parenthood. So what's going on with the Trump-Pence regime? Is this greater than we've seen? There's been other conservative presidents, two Bushes, a Reagan. Is this worse, or is this something that's pretty much in that vein, or is something being stepped up?
All I will say is that it's part of their broader agenda to impose their ideology on all people and block patients from accessing sexual and reproductive health services at Planned Parenthood.
So I guess just to wrap up, you're happy with the decision?
We are very happy. Yes, we consider it a victory. We are very happy with the decision.
And that was Carmina Bernardo, Planned Parenthood Senior Director of Public Policy and Regulatory Affairs in New York. And Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson announced Thursday that he's retiring after more than 3 years as the city's top cop, a post he took over during one of the most violent chapters in the city's history and amid public outcry over the release of a video showing an officer shooting a black teen 16 times. During a news conference in which Johnson announced his retirement, Mayor Lori Lightfoot said he'd agreed to serve through the end of the year. A successor hasn't been named. Johnson, who joined the force as a patrolman in 1988, signaled earlier in the week that he was mulling retirement because he wanted to spend more time with his family. He said the decision would have nothing to do with an investigation into a recent incident in which he was found asleep behind the wheel of his SUV at a stop sign and his admission to Lightfoot that he had a couple of drinks with dinner that night. And finally, Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire former mayor of New York City, is opening the door to a 2020 Democratic presidential campaign, signaling his dissatisfaction with the current crop of candidates vying to take on President Donald Trump. Bloomberg has not made a final decision on whether to run, according to advisors, but he's taking steps towards a campaign, including filing to get on the ballot in Alabama's presidential primary. Alabama has an early filing deadline and is among the states that vote on Super Tuesday, named for the large number of state contests that day. In a statement on Thursday, Bloomberg advisor Howard Wolfson said the former mayor is worried that the current crop of Democratic presidential candidates is not well positioned to defeat Trump. And that's some of the news for Thursday, November 7th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson for the WBAI, locally run, independent, and listener-sponsored evening news. I'm Paul DiRienzo.